All right. So today we get back to Marquardt, and we've got his chapter on the call. We got a lot to talk about today with regard to the call. So I had you read the pages out of Marquardt, and I had you read this monster CTCR document. All right. And hopefully you plowed your way through everything and you have a good sense of some things, and maybe you got some questions going forward, because there are several issues that are significant, and they kind of grow in significance when you're sitting where you are eyeing a call here within like 7 months or something like that. So it's kind of getting real. So maybe you guys are invested in this. All right, I'm hoping that's the case. All right, so any quick observations about your Marquardt reading? Straightforward, any problems, any surprises? Yep.
7 months, 4 hours, 24 minutes.
7 months, 4 hours, 20, how many minutes? Oh, whatever. So I guess that was pretty good guess, wasn't it? About 7 months, I thought. Yes,
Regarding the Lord's Supper, kind of toward the end, he says, it's never by a layman, recta, right, or legitimate.
Uh-huh.
It never happens de jure.
Uh-huh.
Which I'm guessing de jure means
de jure, I mean, according to law.
Okay. Is there a specific word, is this like a legal use of the word right and recta?
It's making a very clear distinction between legitimate, valid, right, this kind of stuff. And the issue really comes down to the questions of sacramental efficacy. So in other words, a sacrament is efficacious never because of who does it.
Right.
It's efficacious because God works through it. So in other words, if a lay person gets up and does the sacrament, is it really the sacrament? Answer is?
Yes.
Yes. Should he do it?
No.
So it's not right.
Okay.
But it is valid.
Okay.
That's what he's getting at.
And how is it not legitimate?
It's the same thing about, is it the way it should be done? It's not the way it should be done.
Okay.
And so it's carefully parsing terms and words, and we often use those words, frankly, synonymously, and so that's why it gets a little difficult. And so they're trying to parse out the words and try to make it clear. So in other words, this is important. Your people will get this. I get people sometimes telling me, I was at some liberal church this weekend, and they had ladies helping in communion. I made sure I didn't go to that table. Like, if a woman's hand touches it, all the power fades out of it, and it's not really the sacrament anymore. That's not true. So in other words, is it still a valid sacrament? Yeah. Now, you might get heebie-jeebies up there because you don't like it, but it's still the sacrament. It's not like, oh, phew, I got the right sacrament. I was close, though, there for a minute. Now, people tell you, you've heard this kind of thing. It's like, I made sure I went to the dude. Okay. because good thing, otherwise you wouldn't have gotten it. No, it's there. There are other issues, and that's the point.
Okay?
Yes, Nicholas.
To this topic, he said when, for example, when encasement and woman serve it or administer it,
yeah.
Then he said it's schismatic. But
it's what?
She does something.
Oh, she's being schismatic.
Schismatic,
yeah. Yeah.
And I wondered if we think of schismatic or heterodox, because it's contrary to the...
You can take your terms. Either one fits.
Okay.
I think he's going for schismatic there because this is just an intentional, willful action just to cause trouble. And I think there's something to that. So in other words, is she helping because there really aren't any men anywhere around who can help? Or is it because they're trying to push the envelope? And it's usually because they're trying to push the envelope, which means they're being schismatic. All right.
Isn't that kind of his argument about the emergency thing?
Yeah, we'll get to that too. That's critical. All right, one more, Adam.
At the very end, he says purely assisting functions such as reading printed sermons in the pastor's absence. He's talking about how lay can do it.
Mm.
If the proclamation is the word of God, how is a pre-written sermon by someone else any different than one that's written by him and then approved by a pastor before him?
It's not. The whole point is, in what capacity is he doing it? And so in other words, if the pastor calls up at 3 a.m. and says, I'm not going to be able to get to church this morning. There's no one else available. And the pastor says, I'll send you a link to my sermon. You can get up in the pulpit and read it. So the elder gets in the pulpit and says, Pastor Frank's dying this morning, so I'm here to do the sermon in his place. And here's what he has for you this morning. And then he reads it. So whose sermon is it? Yeah, I think it's Pastor Frank's. Okay. And now, now you're getting at, so should a lay person, can he write his own sermon under the auspices of the pastor? Now we're into a different animal altogether. Because now we're saying, hey, this pastor wants to deputize layperson this morning, let him get in the pulpit and play pastor for a little bit. That's a different animal altogether. Even though it looks like it's the same, layperson doing something in the pulpit, different situation completely because of what's going on, what's driving it, what the thinking is. Okay? One more. Even though I said that, you're next.
It's not a question, but
all right, comments are fun.
At the end of the CTCR document,
yes.
Are you going to talk about, it said Dr. Marquardt was one of those that submitted in the Pope Doctor.
And yes, he did.
Are you going to talk about
that?
Oh,
if I have time. If I get to anything this morning, yeah. This afternoon, yes. Yes, Nicholas.
Would you say it should be articulated if the sermon is written by...
Oh, it should actually be articulated. It needs to be said. In other words, when the layperson gets in the pulpit, he needs to say why he's there and what he's doing. And probably he wouldn't get in the pulpit anyway. He'd probably just stand at the lectern, which would be even smarter semantically. All right. Good. Now, highlights in Marquardt. Let's go. First key thing he gets at is who does the calling? Let's be clear on this because we're talking today about the call. All right, and obviously when we talk about, I always start with this black one and it always fades out. All right, I won't do that again. So we talk about the call, what are we talking about? Yep.
God's calling immediately through a church.
All right, excellent. So we're talking about the call, into the office of the Holy Ministry. This is what we're clear about. And I want to be clear, I'm not talking about any other call or whatever. I'm talking about the call into the office of the Holy Ministry. So we're going to keep ourselves to that. And we're not going to get distracted by, now what about DCEs and teachers? We'll deal with that later because they get calls in the LCMS. We'll save that discussion. So that whole auxiliary office is later. But today I'm talking about, everything I say today about the call has to do with the office of the Holy Ministry. Or the predictum. So that's what I'm talking about. Okay? So I'm talking about the call into the office. And it is the call done immediately through Christ Church, but who's actually doing the calling? God Himself. Christ is doing the calling. Now, what's kind of cool here is we're seeing some parallels to what we're talking about with the Word and the preaching, right? And all that ecclesiology, Christology connections, because the call then has two aspects, doesn't it? It has very definitely a divine aspect. And the divine aspect is, who's doing the calling? God is. So God calls. God calls. And who is putting that man in the office in that place? God is. He is Christ's pastor. So God calls. But, hey, there's also a human aspect, is there not? And what is the human aspect? God does it immediately. And what is the means He uses? A church. And by intention, church is here rather vague and wide, isn't it? And immediately, most of you are already dropping into your congregationalist upbringing. You're thinking, oh yeah, congregation, church. But I'm keeping this nice and vague. Church. God calls through His church. And so what might the church be? Let's go back to day one. It's the whole kit and caboodle. It's the congregation, but it's a whole lot more too. And God uses all of this, but the church is obviously going to be people. And what's the other key aspect we've been defining here? People and pastor. And we've been making this kind of twofold definition, which I believe to be very important. The church is the sheep and their shepherd, which is Christ, but their under shepherd who is making sure it's being done. The fifth mark of the church, according to Luther's long list of seven, is the office of the Holy Ministry. Pastor and people together are church. All right? So, that means that a call comes from God through His human means of the church being people and pastor. All right? We're all good on this? Now, how human does this human part get? It can get pretty human. It can get pretty human. So, might there be, like, every once in a while, a little finagling going on in the call process where somebody says, hey, you should call my son-in-law to this church. And it'd be really great to have my daughter back here really close. And he's just the perfect man for this. So the call committee works it through him. Yeah, he's the guy. So, is that the guy that God wanted there? It is. Did mother-in-law want him there too? Yes. So who got their way?
Not the call, the candidate.
All right, now, so did God get his way?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And did the people get their way? Yeah, maybe. You know, but see, the point is, you can't get all worked up about, no, wait a minute, there were some human fingers touching it. I think it's all messed up. They're both going on here. Now, there are two sets of twofoldness I want to deal with here. So we're going to start with the human aspect, then I'm going to come back and talk a little bit more about this twofoldness. But Chemnitz is our first quote I want to go to. And this is great on 146, bottom of the page, footnote 4. Chemnitz is writing in his Ministry, Word, and Sacraments, which is a great little text. By the way, if you ever are looking for something to read which is solid and really cool stuff, pick up Chemnitz's Enchiridion. I've always tried to figure out something I can have an excuse for making you read it, but I haven't found it yet. But his Enchiridion is tremendous. Solid, basic, good outline of all of theology. Really good stuff. Chemnitz is a good theologian. So Chemnitz writes this, but do Anabaptists, okay, Anabaptists are the radical Reformation. What's their attitude toward the office of the ministry? Anyway. Nothing special, okay, no big deal, because they're anti-anything that smells Catholic, okay? So, but do Anabaptists do right, who entrust the whole right of calling to the common multitude, which they take the word ecclesia to mean, read congregationalism, okay? With the ministry and the pious magistrate excluded? By no means. For the church in each place is called and is the whole body embracing under Christ the head all the members of that place. Therefore, as the call belongs not only to the ministry, Rome, nor only to the magistrate, which would be a kind of a statism, so also it is not to be made subject to the mere will and whim of the common multitude. For no part, whether either one or both of the others excluded, is the church. But the call should be and remain in the power of the whole church with due order observed. Isn't that cool? So what's Chemnitz saying? You can't just say only the people call, nor only the pastor or the clergy call. It's got to be both together. Now, the wrinkle in all this is throwing in the pious magistrate, which causes Marquardt a little heartburn. He gets kind of worked up about that because, oh, wait a minute, what's that got? It sounds like church-state getting blended. But remember, this is an issue for civil affairs, left-right stuff. But in Luther's day, the magistrate, in Luther's thinking, absolutely was responsible for what was going on in the church and had a stake in that as well, and that was fine. And it's not like Luther's being inconsistent. Luther's right on track with his theology, but that's another class, another topic for another time. And we'll get to that a little bit later on here. But what's cool to recognize at this point is Chemnitz saying, who's doing the calling? Both. The church as a whole, both together. And both have their role to play in this. Now, Marquardt's going to run with this and unpack this. And I think this is exactly where we need to go in all this. Because this is coming to terms with exactly who's doing the calling. And in most of our pious LCMS upbringing, we have come to believe the people, the congregation does the calling. And what role does the pastor play? No, it's just the people doing this. In fact, this plays out into some rather time-honored practices I've heard about. I've heard about congregations where like there might be a senior pastor and they're calling an associate pastor. And so the senior pastor says, well, the call is coming from the congregation, so I'm going to recuse myself from this entire process. And I won't sit on the committee or even be present at the meetings. You heard of these things? Yeah, this is not uncommon. Because you see, this is the congregation's call. I have nothing to do with it. What would Chemnitz say to that dude? You're wrong. You're absolutely part of this. Get in there, get in the room and have part of this. What are you doing recusing yourself? You see, this is a classic example of theology having immediate implications for really immediate practical stuff. And it's important. And I think we have allowed a lot of our, frankly, congregationalist thinking to just overtake a lot of our practice, and we're not being consistent with ourselves. And that's where Chemnitz is so helpful here. All right, so that's what he's getting at here. Now, we need to recognize then it's going to be pastor and people together, and they're both going to be involved in this call process, and that's what Marquardt drives here at the beginning part of this, which is, I think, quite good. All right, so that means then that ordinarily, how does it work? Well, the people are involved. In our church today, how are the people involved? What is the role they play in calling? They actually issue it. All right? So a congregation gets together, put together a call committee. And are there any rules about that? Well, it depends on the constitution of the individual congregation, but is there any theological way you have to do that? No. Could the call committee be the entire congregation having a great big mix-it-up potluck? brouhaha? Yeah, could be. Could the call committee be one person entrusted by the congregation to do the job? Yeah, it could absolutely be. In fact, if the congregation wanted to tell their senior pastor, "Pastor, we trust you, you call the right guy," would that be legit? 100%. Be 100% legit. Could certainly do that. So that's how it goes. So that's how it ordinarily works. And then is the pastor involved, the clergy involved? And the answer is yes. Now, ordinarily today, where does the clergy come into play when it comes to calling? What role do they play? Just think about this a little bit. Yeah, James.
Well, the districts will provide names of candidates.
This is at the very upfront. Typically, when a congregation is looking for a call, where do they start? They go to their district president, usually via their circuit counselor, circuit visitor, and they say, "Hey, we're vacant. We'd like a pastor." And the district president is responsible to provide a call list, theoretically, with some insight and direction into the needs of the congregation, the needs of the skill sets of pastors, and he puts together a list of people who are appropriate for that place, and he gives them the list. So has the clergy been involved? Yeah. All right. And is it even appropriate then for the congregation members maybe to seek out other clergy they know and say, "Hey, we're looking for a new pastor. Any suggestions?" Is that appropriate? Yeah. Actually, it is. And that would be clergy getting involved and the pastors being involved. Now, is that the end of the clergy's involvement today in our world? No. What else? The ordination service itself. So when it comes time, or the installation, when it comes time for that man to be put into the office in that place, who does it? The pastors. See, the ordination is not done by the lay people. The laity are present as the worshiping congregation, but who's putting that man in the office? The clergy are. And so typically how this thing works is the congregation issues the call with the guidance of pastors, and then when it comes time for his acceptance of the call, he does that, and when we're going to put him into the office, it's the clergy, it's the office, carrying out the work of putting him into that office in that place, and it's the church coming alongside. And essentially, it's this. The pastors, the clergy, are basically saying, we, as the church, are saying, this dude is ready and fit, he's in. And that's what ordination is all about. Ordination is basically the church, through its called men, its clergy, saying, this man is also in. He's part of this. And how do we know this? Because God has been working through his education, through his call, and now through us putting him in the office, he's in the office. And so it's this kind of interesting mixture of all these things happening at once. So what is it that actually makes a pastor? Is it the call you get at the end of April? Is it your acceptance of the call? Is it when you actually move the boxes into the parsonage or into your office? Is it when you step into the sanctuary for the first time? Is it when you get ordained? Is it when you get installed? When do you become a pastor? And what's the answer? It's the whole entire process, including stepping into the office. Maybe not so much, but that's all part of it. It's the whole entire process. You are a pastor, not at any one given moment. And I think we make a mistake, because if we're a congregationalist, what we would say, when do you become a pastor? When I accept the call, okay? When I get it and accept it, boom, I'm in. If I'm a clericalist, when do I become a pastor? At the ordination. There's when the magic. I get it. Now I feel it. And that's when it happens. But if I'm going to really be faithful, it's the whole thing. It's not just this or just this. It's the whole process. And so it's kind of interesting when people talk about, I'm becoming a pastor. Well, yeah, it is a becoming thing. And even now, you guys are now at the status of candidates. You are becoming pastors. You're getting close. You can almost start to smell it. Okay? In the spring, the stench gets really strong. I mean, the scent. And so it's coming close. It's coming close. All right, so that's what we're talking about here. All right, now he gets into this whole thing then about ordination and what ordination is. And I was taught, as Marquardt complains, that ordination is nothing more than the first installation. That's what I was taught. So in other words, ordination is your first installation, and that's all it is. So what's the problem with that?
A lot of ordinations don't happen at
So ordinations don't always happen at the first installation church. That's a practical issue which has direct bearing on this whole question, or has connections to this whole question. So what else is wrong with just saying that ordination is nothing more than your first installation? There's a sense in which this is true, but where's this kind of limp? Yeah, Adam.
Takes away some of the divine role of it.
Yeah, it does take away some of this divine aspect of what's kind of going on. And Marquardt even starts to talk about what he calls the plus of ordination. And now we need to tread a little careful here, but I want to tread into this area because I think he's right about this. He talks about the plus of ordination. And what he means is there's something going on at ordination which is not going on at every single installation. Because when a pastor takes a call subsequently in his career, in his service to the church, he's going to be installed again and again and again, different places, different times, and be installed. But his ordination doesn't get repeated. It's just there. And the ordination is something that kind of lingers. And there's actually a really important concept to get through here if we start to recognize the plus of ordination, because it starts to make sense of a lot of the way we think and even practice in our church body, which apart from this thinking makes no sense at all. Because if my ordination is nothing more than my first installation, what happens if I have resigned my call, and I'm not yet installed at my new parish? What am I for that time in between, according to this kind of strict definition, congregational-wise? I'm nothing. I'm a layperson. Yeah, well, I'm unemployed, yeah. But I am not in the office. I'm not. Okay? And that's kind of a strange sort of a thing. And now let's go to this other strange kind of thing. What about at the end of a guy's long career? And he's been serving the church for a long time, but now it's getting harder and he's starting to slow down. And so he resigns his call. And he's no longer called by this congregation. Is he still a pastor or not? A strict congregationalist would have to say, no. No call, no pastor. But if there is a plus to ordination, his ordination hasn't been rescinded, has it? I would argue no. He's still in the office. And to me, this is one of the critical things to recognize that's going on in ordination. Ordination is the church saying, this man is now being set aside to serve in this office, and he is in this office. And this is bigger than just this congregation. In other words, your call does not attach only to one place. Okay, your call does, but your role as a pastor in the church is not bound only to this one place. That's why a pastor can do pulpit supply. Or he might do a kind of a situation in Lent sometimes where you share, you take turns doing a little circuit kind of rotation around, preach the same sermon six times. Well, what right do I have to be in this pulpit? It's not my pulpit. You hear some strict guys talking this way. Oh, it's not my pulpit. I can't preach here. Nonsense. Are you a pastor in Christ Church? Yeah. Can you come into this church at their invitation and share God's word with them with the authority of the office there in that place? I would say yes. Can you do the sacrament in that place? Yes. And see, now the implications for this are significant. So if I'm a called and ordained servant of the word because I'm called to the seminary, can I go to a church somewhere down the road and do the sacrament legitimately or not?
So for Glendale's sake?
Well, yeah, I would say I can because I'm there serving in behalf of the fact that I'm in the office. And that's the plus of ordination. Okay? And so a retired guy also can go to a congregation and say, as a ordained servant of the word, I'm not called right now, but I'm ordained, but I'm here because I'm still in Christ Church and I'm here on behalf of the church to speak God's truth to you, and I can forgive sins and I can do the sacrament. Why? Because I'm in the office still. And I think this is the right way to think of this, but we are, you need to recognize, kind of stepping over a boundary that we're a little, sometimes get people uncomfortable with, because we're saying there's a little more going on here. Now, does that mean once I get ordained, I do have this indelible character? Not at all. And there's a difference between a guy who begins to slow down or who finds himself between calls and a guy who says, I am stepping out of the office of the ministry so I can go home and run the family hardware business. That's different. And you see, or I am stepping out of the office and I'm going to go now and sell Thrivent. That's different because he is now moving himself out of the office. He's not kind of between calls. He's not a pastor who's just basically losing the physical stamina to pull it off and kind of just, slowing down towards his final exit in death. He is doing an actual, I'm pulling myself out of the office. That's different. So, a guy who's selling Thrivent, who's got an MDiv, is he authorized to go and preach anywhere or do the sacrament anywhere? No. No. He might be a sharp layperson with an actual, like, you know, he's got an MDiv for crying out loud. That's pretty cool. But is he a pastor because he has an MDiv? And there's a difference here then. And so we need to think carefully about what's kind of going on here and what's happening and not get hung up on, you know, terminology or degrees. What matters is this man in the office? And the thing that helps to bring clarity to this whole discussion is to always ask yourself the question is the man in the office or not? And if he's in the office, he's in the office. And if he's not, he's not. And what puts you in the office is the church's call, which thereby results in ordination. You're in the office. And I would argue that until the church or the man says otherwise, he's in the office. And basically, it's the church who has to say otherwise. Because even if a man recuses himself and steps back, the church has to agree. And we actually formally recognize that nowadays by doing what? We remove him from the roster, which is basically the big official moment. He's no longer in. No longer a pastor. And that's the terminology we use. He's not rostered anymore. And some churches would call it being defrocked or whatever, but we would just say he's not rostered anymore. And you might be removed for nice reasons or not nice reasons, but either way, you're not on the roster. All right.
This might get into some fuzzy territory, but
it might.
Talking about a guy like resigning his call, going to self-right. Now let's talk about someone who's in a different position, let's say at a Concordia University. Mm. Where he is a pastor, and he serves in a function that has nothing to do with teaching, but he still sometimes will get called to that position.
Yeah, this gets very fuzzy, and you're quite right to preface it that way. So we can think of some positions at universities, and we can get even more fuzzy by thinking about people who are at the IC. Suppose I have my MDiv, and I'm working at the IC, but basically what I'm doing is I'm administering this great big business. And there's not one thing about what I'm doing that smacks of the pastoral office besides I'm talking to pastors once in a while. So am I still in the office? And my opinion would be no. And I would say he's not. Now, for IRS tax purposes, we like him to be in the office because now he's self-employed. But that's another part of the story we'll talk about later.
But a lot of times in those situations, even at the IC, those people will be called.
Oh, absolutely. And absolutely. Because of the legal tax purposes.
Just making sure I'm clear.
And there are theological reasons people might want it too. But it gets, see, this does not help my case, frankly. It doesn't, because our practice gets goofy. And then you'll have a DCE who she's been trained, she's got a DCE, and so she gets a job at the IC and she's a secretary. But they find out that she's a DCE. Oh, cool, we can call you now. So we're going to call you to be DCE instead of just hiring you. Well, what's the difference? The difference is, what, is it 7.5% FICA? Seriously. The difference is the employer has to pay 7.5% of his income because of Social Security tax. And if he's self-employed, who pays it all? I do. Yeah, the employee does. Sweet. So it's a good deal for the employer.
But that's the tangent we weren't
going
to go on.
No, we're not going there yet. We'll save that for my auxiliary day. All right, Adam.
So if the man steps out of the office to run the hardware store because he's tired and burnt out, and several years later feels led to the call to come back, does he need to be colloquied or go through that
certification? I would say yes. Again? I would say yes. He should go through the process of being colloquized. He should. It probably will be a very streamlined one, rather quick one, but he should still go through the process of being put into the office. Absolutely. Yep. Yep. Josh.
SMP pastors?
Yeah. Now, see, in SMP, it's the same thing because that's where the clarity comes in. Because we have to ask the question, is the man in the office or not? So when does an SMP man go into the office?
After the ninth class?
After the ninth class when he gets ordained. That's exactly how it works. And it's carefully thought through, and that's exactly when it happens, which is a big deal. And a lot of congregations have no clue it's a big deal, but we try to impress upon the guys in it, this is a big deal. Because at this moment, you're going from being vicar, student, shut up, do what you're told, to being in the office. And in my opinion, this changes everything. And see, I think this is the theological way to think about it. Because at one moment, you're just layperson. When you get ordained, you are now crossing a threshold. You're now an office holder. And that means you have all the burdens of the office, along with all the responsibilities and opportunities. You are able to do word and sacrament ministry on behalf of Christ Church, but you're also responsible for it now. Very different. And this is why it's so important. That's why I'm frankly, pounding this home so much because I want you guys to get this. If you're in the office, you're in the office. And I don't care if you're the fifth man on a monster staff and your job is just to take care of families and little kids. And that's your job description and you're doing less than some vicars do. I don't care. If you're in the office, you're in the office. And that needs to be understood. Yeah.
Seems like SMP pastors become kind of a second class of people in the office, though.
This is an unfortunate reality, and it's part of how this we talk about this. In my opinion, they shouldn't be, and we need to treat them that way. I do think that eventually these issues are going to keep on getting thought about and hashed around, and the time will come when, you know, it's already happening in many places that people look at a pastor as a pastor. And you see, there used to be a distinction between, well, were you a Springfield guy or a St. Louis guy? Because the St. Louis guys had the academic training and they went through the system. Springfield guys were the second career guys. And guys like my dad, who came out of the seminary in 62, he didn't even have a degree. He just had a certificate. And so, he didn't have any, he had Greek, no Hebrew. But if you were a St. Louis guy, well, you know, that was the real deal. And in some people's minds, it was like, well, there's Springfield and there's the St. Louis guys. And that kind of faded. And I think the same thing's going to happen with the SMP, frankly. It all depends on, you know, how well they present themselves and how good a job they do. It's going to have a lot to do with it. All right. Okay? We all clear on this? So the critical thing is always to be asking yourself, who are you in the office or not? And what I'm getting at then is, in the human aspect, both the people and the pastor are involved in putting in the office. Now, from the CTCR document, think back to the time of Luther. How did a guy get in the office? What was the process? It was you went to Wittenberg, and you learned your stuff. And when they decided you probably knew enough stuff. When there was a need for a pastor somewhere, they would usually contact the faculty at Wittenberg and say, we need a pastor. And they say, yeah, we got this guy. Hank is pretty good for you. So then what did they do? They sent the guy to the church, and he had to preach a couple times. People decided, yeah, he'll be all right. Or, no. And they would approve it. And then they would send the word back, yay or nay. And then the magistrate would say, all right, I'll sign off and I'll pay for him. Because remember, he was footing the bill. And so the magistrate was involved in deciding this is a good call or not. He would, we'll do this. And so then what would happen is after he'd already gone through the certification process, which was basically face-to-face inventory of, you know, quizzing by the faculty. Bugenhagen and Luther and Melanchthon, whoever happened to be around. How fun would that be? You guys would cherish that. And so and then he would be ordained in Wittenberg by Bugenhagen and sent to his call. That's how it worked. And so was the congregation involved? Well, basically by hearing him preach and deciding if they could deal with it or not. But see, there were even some times where a guy might graduate and the magistrate, the prince would say, hey, I got this little village church and I need a pastor out there because these people really need to hear the word and I need to get them some things put together. Who have you got for me? And so Bugenhagen maybe say, oh, I got this guy. He's perfect. So the prince would say, go. And they would send him and he would arrive. And what role would the congregation have? Basically, if they start calling him Pastor Schmidt, guess what? He's our pastor. Have they received him? Yep. And so their role is basically to receive what had been given to them. And you might say, well, they've been cut out of the process. No, they're still involved. They could say, he is not our pastor. We refuse. And then he wouldn't be. But if they simply start calling him Pastor Schmidt, then the machinations of all the clergy and the magistrate have done their thing, and the people simply receive what's there. But they're still participating by receiving him and making him their pastor. Is that making sense? So what I'm trying to get across here is the exact details of how this works out don't matter that much. Rite vocatus, you know, AC-14 is pretty malleable. And it's not like it has to be this way. There's all kinds of things that could happen. You know, we could have a system where we could sit around and we could just assign you guys and we could assign every call after that in a very Episcopalian kind of system. Would that be legit? Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, James.
Just to clarify, in that 1500s case, they learned their stuff at the seminary of Wittenberg and then they were certified.
That's right.
Murder board, and then they went out and did their preaching. And
yeah, that's right.
Okay. That's right. That's right. Yeah, now the certification happened before. I missed my timing there a little bit. Presumably they would do their quizzes before they went out and started preaching. Yeah. Yep. David.
Can you speak to how this works in the ELCA? I mean, that's where I grew up.
Yeah.
And I think I heard that when the pastor retires or whatever, like they're done. Like, they're not considered in the office anymore?
That I can't speak to. I don't know that much. I know the ELCA has a more Episcopalian structure, and the ELCA congregations don't own their buildings. The Synod does. The ELCA does, and so that's a huge difference. And so you don't have the kind of congregational autonomy that we have. How they look at their calls and when they start and stop, I'm not as familiar with, so I can't speak to that. All right, 156. This is kind of starting to summarize this stuff. That said, however, one like us must agree with Fagerberg. This is a nice quote. This is from, according to AP 14, Apology 14, the call also includes a form of ordination. Well, it does. And now Marquardt sums this up. Dogmatically, this means that the whole church or congregation, this is the very top of 156, the whole church or congregation, that is both hearers and preachers, must be allowed their rightful roles in the process of placing a man into the ministry. Exactly. Okay? So we're keeping everybody involved, not trying to parcel anybody out. All right. Now, that's that. Now, I also want to speak, this is kind of getting to the divine call stuff a little bit, but I want to go back to this divine human aspect. And I was already kind of started off here. It is a call from God, but it is human. And even if there are, like, you know, finagling and things going on in the background, it doesn't diminish the divine aspect. And in all seriousness, how do you know it's a divine call? Because when you open up the divine documents and you look at them, it's going to say right on top of it, divine call. And it's going to be signed. So is it really from God? It's going to be signed by God, the finger of God himself. Charlton Heston. Yeah. You hear, and you guys will walk out of the call service with your hair blown back. And that's the way it'll be. All right. And you walk really slowly from then on. All right. It's the divine call because it's from God. It really is. And we kind of laugh about it, and we have a tendency to diminish it, but it really, we need to see it that way. It is from God. God has worked through all these human things, and he has accomplished his purpose, and this is a call from God himself, and I can treat it that way. And that's how I should treat it. So, when you are in the parish someday, and you're serving your congregation, and you have another call to another church, which one is from God? Both are. And so when people say things like, I have to figure out what is God's will for me in this situation, what should they really be saying? Which one is God's will? Both, or you wouldn't have them. And that confuses things, but actually it brings things back down to where they need to be, which is instead of trying to spiritualize this into some kind of big wrestling match, trying to discern God's will for my life, you can simply relax and say, well, God's will is very clear here. He wants me here, and he wants me here. So which one should I do? And you get to pick. Yeah, and you can flip a coin, or you can talk to your wife. Take your pick. I want to take some of the stigma out of this and some of the nonsense where we, like I said, we kind of make us all holy and pious sounding. It can be very real. So you look at the situation, you say, wow, both of these are cool calls. Both are going to use my gifts really well, and they're both going to be really exciting. One's really close to my wife's family. Would she love that? Would that be good for the kids? Yeah? Can we do that? Yes. And you don't have to feel like, oh no, I'm getting some benefit. It can't really be from God. It must be Satan tempting me. No, don't do that. Just enjoy the gift. Or you get a call and, you know, everything, all things are equal, and one's paying 10 grand more a year. Wow. Oh no, that must really be from Satan because there's money involved. No, no. You have human responsibilities. You got a vocation, wife and husband. You know, you're a husband to your wife, and you got kids, and you got things to pay, take care of and pay off. Do you need the money? Is that bad? No. No, this is okay. See, you don't have to somehow, you know, oh, it's all divine. It's both of these things at once.
I've heard of guys getting put on a call list and even receiving a call in advance saying, hey, we'd like to put you on a call list. Are you interested? Would you say then that it's wrong to say, no, I'm not interested, don't put me on a list?
Yeah, see, my practice has always been, I won't ever tell God what to do. You do what you want. But I'm making no promises. I mean, I think a lot of congregations are putting the feelers out. You know, we're not going to put a guy who's going to turn us down. And, you know, you take your chances. You want to call me? You know, because what I tell people is, I'll consider any call, but I'm not going to let you know before I have the call in hand. That's silly. It's your problem. You deal with it. All right. Yep.
I'm having trouble understanding how congregations who are going to get a lot of the men in this room are involved in the process.
Well, are they? In your exact situation, are the congregations that are out there right now thinking, wow, we've been vacant for a while, what are we going to do? Oh, I guess we can call from the Psalm. All right. Are they involved?
I mean, they're trusting the seminary and the council of presidents to give them the right person.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, how involved is that? Is sort of
how involved did they have to be?
Good question.
You see, let's go back to the Reformation time. How involved were those congregations that were just told, here's your pastor? It's kind of what's happening here. And I would say they are involved to a lesser degree maybe than they might be down the road, but they're involved enough. And they have essentially said, we're willing to receive the man you give to us. That's enough. That's enough. And they don't have to be any more involved than that. That's plenty.
Could they be more involved?
Could they be? Possibly. They're actually, frankly, they're getting a lot more than they used to be.
So it's like designated calls.
Designated calls, interviews, this is where the things change. When I came through this system about 30 years ago, nobody got interviewed for any reason except somebody who might be going into a teaching situation to make sure you're competent to teach what needed to be taught. That was it. And even if you're going into a team ministry, it didn't matter. There were no interviews granted, none. And nowadays, good grief. And interviewing, everybody's got, you know, got interviews going. It's almost like it's an expected thing. And I'll have a few more things to say about that, too, if we have time. All right. Yeah, Mark.
My Vicarage congregation called someone specifically from the seminary.
Designated call.
Yeah.
Yep. And so, yeah, that's fine. And that happens. And that's being honored now. Like I said, when I was a student, that wouldn't even be honored. That wasn't allowed. But now that's happening. And so it's much more involved than it used to be. Is that okay? Yeah. It can be okay. And I mean, I don't have a problem with that. But then again, we have to be careful with the balance on this kind of thing. So let's go ahead and get into this now, because I'm kind of on that page and I don't want to come back to it. So there's this kind of balance between these two things. And this is kind of getting into stuff from the divine call from the CTCR document. But these things are both at work here, and we can't discount one or the other. And there's a tendency, as the document admits, and what'd you think of the document? Pretty good or not? Yeah, pretty straightforward, good stuff. It has the thing most CTCR documents do. Oh, I can put that over here. Right. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, isn't that good?
Yeah, there you go.
There. So this document is pretty helpful. Like most CTCR documents, it has the reality is you read through the whole document and you put it down and you say, oh, what do we need to change in the church body today on the basis of this document? And the answer is nothing. Everything's just fine. Everything's fine. CTCR documents are notorious for this. They just kind of reaffirm status quo. It's like you do this big study and it comes out the other end. Look, everything's just fine the way it is. Oh, good. We don't have to change. All right. But there is some good stuff in this one, laying things out. Anybody know the author? You're not supposed to know these things. Aaron wrote this one. Yeah. And see, there's always a first draft, and then they get through committee. And sometimes once the committee gets done with them, they're unrecognizable. But this one, there still has some errant hints in there, like not all adiaphora are created equal. Did you catch that? That's standard. And big push for continuing education. Yes, yeah, one of his, always there on that. So anyway, now, back to the CTCR document. The document rightly acknowledges that through the church's history, we kind of have this kind of pendulum swing between these two poles. And I will vouch for the time when I was a student here. I was kind of on the tail end of this. This was still when we were probably trying to emphasize maybe the divine aspect. So no interviews, no kind of conversations, no conferences, none of that kind of stuff. And we're going to take a man, we're going to put him there, and God's going to direct this. And this does still persist. And I find this, honestly, most frequently probably in a lot of wives who have this kind of very spiritual attitude. Like, if it's really from God, then human hands shouldn't be touching it in any way. And so it'll just kind of come down from heaven, and we'll go, oh, it's from God. Okay, and we know. And we wouldn't want, you know, even the suggestion of sitting down and talking with Becker and kind of telling him what you want, maybe we shouldn't say anything, we should just kind of leave it up to God. Anybody know what I'm talking about? So, yeah, JD, he's there.
PK, I'm married to PK.
Yeah, see, you get this piety that's there, and it comes through. No, seriously, it's this kind of thing. And I've encountered this. And it's like, and you even get this later on, too. Like, you know, if a call just comes de novo, out of the blue, bolt out of the blue. It's like, wow, that's really from God. But if you've been kind of talking to people behind the scenes and kind of working things a little bit, then that's not really from God. You know, that's really just a human call. And so we have this tendency. So this was kind of the way things were when I was a student. I think now we are sliding this direction. And this is what I have a concern about, which is what I call the eHarmony.com attitude towards the call. Because, Neil Clark Warren wants us to believe that somewhere out there is my perfect soulmate. And if you use the right tools, you will find your soulmate. And oh, it's going to be beautiful. And we have congregations out there thinking somewhere at the seminary is our perfect pastor. And you are sitting here today thinking somewhere out there is my perfect congregation. And I'm going to find the perfect match. And so I'm going to go through interviews, and I'm going to talk, and I'm going to fill out my set and my PDFs, and well, not PDFs, my set and my, what is the other one? PIF, yes. Yeah. I'm going to fill out all my forms, and I'm going to fill them out so carefully, and I'm going to get the perfect congregation. Okay? And so you're really into this kind of thing because you're trying to get it. And then, here's the problem with eHarmony.com is, it never works because, shh, don't tell me. Howard Wass, this is bringing to another topic here, but Howard Wass has this great quote. He says, you always marry the wrong person. And what he means by that is, the reality is, no matter how hard you try to get the perfect match, reality always settles in. And the person isn't quite, you know, they're human, and they have weird habits and peculiarities, and like, wow. And the problem is, if you marry someone thinking they're your soulmate, you're always going to be disappointed. And so then, if you really are committed to finding your soulmate, what must you do? Get rid of that mistake and go find your soulmate. Seriously. And you're going to encounter this people in your congregations. God wants me to be happy, doesn't he? God wants me to find my soulmate, doesn't he? It's like this mission from God. And people get weird about it. And see, I think the same thing comes in the call process. We work so hard to match up personality types and needs and strengths and skills and everything. And we put the guy there, and it's like, oh, this is a match made in heaven. It's going to be the eHarmony.com perfect pastor marriage. And then it turns out he's just a bozo dude like everybody else. And the carriage engagement, what is this? And the pastor's thinking, what is this? These people are annoying. What's going on? And see, we create all these false expectations, and it's not healthy. So I think we have to be really careful to recognize both things going on here. It's a human thing, but it's a divine thing. And does God put you where he wants you? Yeah. Is that always going to be a perfect fit? No. Is it going to be uncomfortable and awkward? Yeah. Let's just deal with it. It's okay. Quit looking for the perfect match. It doesn't exist. And so we have to kind of keep the balance here a little bit and not idolize these things. Now, this also, I'll say a word about this since you guys are at the front end of this. Be really careful about what you expect out of interviews, okay? Be really careful. Even be careful about deciding you're going to do them, because what's really gained by this whole process? And I'll also encourage you very strongly, when you fill out your sets and your PIFs and all this kind of stuff, be honest, because if you're fudging so you can make yourself look more attractive, you might actually get yourself called someplace where you're not going to be in sync. And what would be better? Getting the perfect church that really doesn't fit with what you think, or being honest up front about things. So be upfront about what's going on and let people know. I've had students who have made the decision, candidates, I'm not going to do any interviews, none. And that's just their position. And there's a lot of their peers will think, oh, you're nuts, what are you doing? You're crazy. And a couple of them ended up with these really cool calls, and they're thrilled where they are still to this day. And there are guys who've gone through the interview process, and it's bitterly disappointing. So there's nothing to be, there's no magic thing here. I'm not saying don't do the interview process, but I'd really caution against, what are you trying to get out of it? And what are you trying to do? And, I think the interview went really well. Well, come on, guys. Is this a divine call or not? And if you want to cut a congregation some slack and give them an interview, that's fine. But maybe we're actually making a mistake by doing too much of this interviewing. That's kind of my opinion. And we're creating all kinds of false expectations and ideas that we're going to learn all kinds of stuff through this interview and try to get the right guy instead of just trusting the COP and the placement process to do their thing. And I lean back that direction. So I have this dream of an entire fourth-year class just announcing, we won't do any interviews. And just what that would, the message that would send. I think it would be so cool. But that would take a lot of courage, and it would take a lot of do that next year. Because you guys might sign on, but I know a lot of your wives are like, you nuts? So anyway, Adam.
Are you referring specifically to coming out of the sim, that first call?
Yes.
Or any call?
No, the first one. I'm talking about you guys. Yeah. Well, you can have that position later on, too. You can just tell a congregation, oh, I don't do interviews. And then, you might be stuck where you are forever, but is that all bad either? I mean, We I think over worry these things too much, and like I said, I think we work too hard trying to get the perfect match. If you know the language of where you're going and you've got the skills, you know, the basic skill set of being a pastor, I'm really of the opinion any one of you could serve in any parish. I really believe that. I also have the opinion that you can make any marriage work if you want to. You know, it's just a matter of deciding to do it. So, what's the LA? Unless she kills you first. Yeah, that's true. Peter.
How would you say that the trend of pastors staying at their first call for less and less time fits into?
Actually, it's increasing a little bit. It used to be worse.
Okay.
And that's part of the justification for trying to improve the call process so that these things go a little longer. That's always the problem. And that's why if we just send a guy out there, well, how long is he going to last before he gravitates back for where he wants to go? Which is why things like geography and closeness to family is not irrelevant. I mean, things matter. I mean, this is just realities. And so we do try to take those things into account. And that's why we go through the process and we do have the interviews and we talk and stuff. But see, a lot of that stuff can get sorted out without having interviews with the congregations getting involved. And as the CTCR document points out, there's this kind of little throwaway sentence in there that, you know, there's a fair amount of angst that gets created where you got one guy who's had like 5 interviews and then his friend has had none. No, that's real good for camaraderie and spirit in the class, you know. But it's just not real cool. And I don't know what the real advantage of that is. And then you hear about congregations all fighting over the same guys. Like, well, come on, no guy's Superman. What is that? So, anyway. So I am convinced that we need to be trusting of both things. There's the human aspect. We need to pay attention to that. But there's also the idea that wherever God puts you is where God wants you. Thrive there and go for it. So that's a good way to look at it. All right, good. Now, next up then. So we got the guy in the office. He's there. What gets him out of the office?
Incompetence.
All right, well, let's go through our list and start at the beginning. What's the first reason you would ever remove a guy from the office?
False doctrine.
All right,
persistent false doctrine.
So false doctrine is the first reason. So the guy is simply holding false views of theology. Who knows what it might be. He could be talking about the need for a second baptism in the Holy Spirit, and you got to have it. He could be talking about questioning whether baptism really saves, or he could be a millennialist, or who knows what. Or it could be an Eastern Orthodox nut who's deciding liturgy is everything. So he's got some kind of false doctrine that is driving him. Okay, that's the issue. Now, it's important also to remember that this is not a matter of he misspoke in one sermon one time. Okay, this is persistent, consistent, willful, won't move. And how hard do you have to work with a dude before you remove him for false doctrine? A long time. And who's going to be involved in that? The whole church, including the clergy and the districts and everything. Because who finally removes a guy for false doctrine? It's a district president. And he acts as a district president, informs the COP, and that's that. And once a guy's been removed, then the whole council of presidents has to be act to put him back on. And it has to be like a supermajority of. So it's a big deal. The threshold is very high. So that's the first one. What's the second reason for removing a man from office?
Offensive conduct or scandalous life.
Immoral life. And so there is something in his life which is not adding up, which is not being in line with God's word. This one confuses people, even though it seems pretty straightforward. All right? Because people start to get really confused with forgiveness. And we have to be clear on this. An immoral life is enough to remove you from the office, even if you're sorry about it, and even if the congregation forgives you. So the pastor who has an illicit affair with whomever, and he is caught, and then he comes to the congregation, and he's got all the right actions and all the right words, and he's broken and repentant. He's even reconciled with his wife, and he's making everything better, and he's working hard at it, and he really means it. And the congregation says, wow, this man is... We love him, and he's so real about this, and he's so transparent, and so part of us, and we want him to still be our pastor. Well, what's the problem? He has removed himself by his immoral life. St. Paul says he must be above reproach. All right? And so his immoral life is reason to remove him from office. And it doesn't matter if he's repentant or not, frankly. He has messed up. He has not lived a life that is in sync with this. Now, you might say, now, wait a minute. That means I have to be perfect? No. But there are sins that are of different grades. And this is something you probably have come to terms with by now. Hopefully, in Systems 3, you dealt with this. Sin is not all equal. Coram mundo, there are big differences in sins. And the consequences are vastly different. And we need to take that into account. And so there are things that are going on in his life that are basically causing a scandal to the congregation and to the community and that necessitate his removal from the office. And that's the issue there. Adam.
Is there ever a point in the future where we are open to restoring that guy to the office?
This is an ongoing debated question right now in the church and even the LCMS, trying to sort that stuff out. You know, what's this mean to be above reproach? What does that actually mean? And is it ever possible for a man who's committed adultery, for example, you know, with a parishioner for, you know, an extended period of time and now he's done it, can he ever come back into the office? And boy, sometimes you want to think, yeah, but other times, you know, I get myself torn on this, mostly because I know people personally who are in this kind of situation, sadly and tragically. And your heart goes out to them, and you think about all their qualifications and what they could offer, but then you think about what God's Word actually says and what you're actually doing to the office. And when it comes right down to it, I probably end up coming down on the side of, for the sake of the office, no. And as hard as that is to hear, that's just where I come down.
Then to take that one step further, we're in the pastoral letters. It talks about his household must be in order.
Yeah. Isn't that something we ignore all the time?
If their children are falling away from the Lord and living immoral lifestyles, does that then make them?
Yeah, I see. I think this is where we are kind of selective in what we decide to deal with. And the scriptural description for a man who's fit for the office is pretty clear. And I think C.T. Sardocism is quite right to point out that in the early church, they were far more concerned about the qualifications of the man than they were about how he got in there. You know, so was Ephesus voting, you know, we want this man to be our pastor, or did Paul just send him? And so this is where you really get the idea of who's putting the guy in the office. So who made Titus the pastor in, what's my name on my little island out there in the middle of nowhere? Cretans, yeah. All Cretans are barbarians, yeah. So I knew I would get it. So who made Titus the pastor in Crete? Did the Cretans vote on it?
No.
No. Who made him the pastor there? Paul did. Whoa. So Paul just sent him. But see, the key thing is not so much how he got there, but who he was. And they were far more interested in who he was. And I think we have, frankly, gotten a little sloppy in that. We're trying to get better. That's why we go through the whole interview process. You know, we ask you guys about your lives. What's going on? What's happening? Because we want you guys to have your act together. And perfect? No. But your act together? Yeah. Frankly. Yeah. That's part of it. And we've always been so careful to kind of just avoid the whole kids thing. You know, yeah, who's going to tell a man how to raise his kids? But I think we need to be a little more upfront with that. You know, if a guy's got kids who are just out of control, does that invalidate his ability to serve in the office? And St. Paul seems to say yes. And I think maybe we need to pay a little more attention to that. It gets so touchy and so, you know, hits close to home, but I think we really need to pay serious attention to that. All right, good? It starts getting scary, doesn't it? Feeling a little twinge in your gut, like, yikes, do I really want to do this? Good. You should feel that, man. You should feel it all the time. This is a serious thing you're doing here. Serious business. All right, so third reason, immoral life. There are more, or aren't there?
Yes, there are more.
Yeah. All right, what's number three?
Deliberate unfaithfulness in the performance.
All right, deliberate unfaithfulness, or we can go with incompetence. We'll go with that one next. So, or inability. That would be the nice way to put it. So the person suffers some kind of debilitating illness or some kind of debilitating disease or an accident that just prevents him. He just simply can't carry it out. It's not just that he's got some kind of, you know, he's lost his mobility, but he lost his ability to think or speak. He has dementia or something. All right, that would be the issue there. All right, what else we got?
Those are two different points on that list.
Well, okay. Deliberate incompetence is refusal to do what you need to do. Refusal to perform. That's different. So I'm going to make that my separate one. So number three is kind of like out of your control. And number four is refusal to perform your duties. And this would be the guy who, instead of making shut-in calls, is just sitting around blogging all day and serving the church by writing really important blogs and stuff like that. All right? So that's refusal to perform your duties. And number five would be a domineering spirit. Now, to be honest, I don't like very much after number two. I think three, four, and five are getting kind of murky. And one of my concerns is that if we start putting things up here like domineering spirit, that's pretty vague. And so you could have a congregation being served by a guy who's actually calling a spade, and telling them what's up. And they can be kind of ticked off about that and decide he's got a domineering spirit. And he really doesn't. He's just being faithful. And he's just annoying some people. But that happens. And so I'm not real crazy about this. On the other hand, I get why Walter puts this on the list, because you've got a guy who comes rolling in who thinks, hey, I am the man. Bow down and listen. That's not cool. He's missing the whole spirit. But I would argue that really these two, four and five, are really a subset of number two, because you're simply failing in the basic, you know, carrying out of what you should be doing as God's pastor. And so I don't know that we really need these here. And for me, incompetence or inability, that's just kind of self-evident. If the guy can't do the task, he can't do the task. But I think really, when it comes right down to it, there are really just two reasons. That's deliberate false doctrine or immoral life. And I think that these two really kind of fit into that immoral life. It's just, it gets into questions of behavior, and is your life conforming to the confession you have? And neither one of these are. Yeah.
So who actually gauges the refusal to perform?
Yeah, see, this is exactly the problem.
Like, they live in a city because they don't want to live in the farm town they're chosen.
Yeah. Yeah, this is exactly the kind of problem. And the way this works is congregations essentially would start the ball rolling, and then they would go to their circuit visitor, and then the district president would get involved, and it's going to have to be essentially the whole church is going to have to be convinced. And so it's going to have to be the people and the pastors. In other words, the district is going to have to decide, and the district president, it's in his court, frankly. District president is the guy who can remove a guy from the roster. He can do it. And so he has to be persuaded that this guy is willfully refusing to do what he should do. It's kind of his call.
They send in like somebody to help.
Oh, there are going to be all kinds of processes that districts have, reconciling this, kind of that. But, you know, if the guy just will not, then eventually the district president might just say, fine, I'll remove you from the roster. And DPs have various ways of dealing with that. You know, it's not consistent from district to district, but that's where it lies. So the authority lies there.
So apart from the congregation, is there any sort of accountability or checkups on
that? Well, see, that's just where it starts coming into what it means to be the church and what it means to be part of a Winkle. And in my opinion, there absolutely should be. And we should be, in a sense, holding one another accountable. The structures are pretty vague on this, frankly. And this is where I'm trying to instill in you guys an understanding of church, which is a lot broader and a lot more encompassing than simply congregation, for the very reason that I think we need to realize we are all responsible for each other.
When you spoke of number three, the incompetence or inability to perform,
yeah,
you alluded to the fact that should only be for his mental faculties.
Yeah, well, I don't want to try to be across the board making rules about these kinds of things. I'm just saying, you know, that if a man is suffering from some kind of a problem that keeps him from doing what he needs to do as a pastor, that would probably qualify. But obviously, most congregations are going to be very long-suffering and charitable on these kinds of things and be very kind about this and not be nasty about driving somebody off. But you could get to a point where you finally have to say, we need a pastor, you're just not doing it, and you're somehow not recognizing that, and that's probably where we get the district involved and help, get some help.
Because I knew a situation happened in my circuit where I don't think the pastor wanted to leave, but
yeah,
he had bone cancer, I think
yeah,
it was, and couldn't walk. And
yeah.
Then they had to...
Yeah, see, this is exactly the kind of stuff I'm talking about. Things can get pretty messy, and that's where Christian charity comes into play, but the congregations do have legit needs, and that's where you have to start trying to get this thing worked out. Hopefully a man is wise enough to recognize, all right, this is what I need to do, but it's hard. Yeah. All right, James.
So when you get into that third area too, you know, incompetence such as an illness, so if I'm going through chemo and I just can't hack it, but at some point I'm going to get better. That would be a little different than
absolutely.
Those first two.
No, absolutely.
The first two, you're gone.
Right.
Whereas that third one, maybe you get removed for a period of time and get brought back.
You might, or maybe you even just, you know, the congregation just does with something else for a while. And
yeah, so that's that sabbatical kind of thing that was talked about
sure.
a little bit too?
Sure.
Falls into that
yes.
category.
And see, none of these are meant to be, especially when it comes to this, it's not like there's rules that if your pastor doesn't get in the pulpit for 6 weeks in a row, okay, you got to, you know, this is very much open to congregations and sorting these things out and honoring the office and honoring the man and the patience kind of thing, like I was saying.
Because what I struggle with in the military, we have the same problem where people wouldn't, you know, be a man, be tough, suck it up.
Yeah.
And what happens is, you know, guy he needs to see a head shrink. He needs to go to a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
But he won't do it because he's afraid, if I do that, yeah, I'm going to be looked upon.
Yep. Yep.
Unfavorably, but I'm trying to help myself. And so what we did in the military, there was a big push to try to not stigmatize, you know, destigmatize that kind of thing. And
yeah.
And I see the same kind of, it's a very similar kind of dynamic.
There is,
you know,
there is.
You need to destigmatize, some of that to get help for people that really are capable.
I agree.
And so that's why I was wondering, in that case, I mean, that's different than
it is.
One and two, for
sure. The biggest concern I've got, just to be real clear here, the biggest concern I've got is congregations deciding we don't like our pastor very much, and so we're going to get rid of him. And I have heard and witnessed these stories as well. There was a guy in circuit, I was in Minnesota, who went on vacation and came back and found out that his pay had been cut. So,
or they changed the locks.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, changed locks. Yeah, and he was a little odd. I mean, I'll admit that. But he wasn't immoral and he wasn't false doctrine. He was just a little odd. So the congregation was tired of his oddness, so they decided they were done. You don't get to do that. That's not the way it works. So I'm trying to make sure that we respect the call and respect the office.
Yeah, but I think as we're talking about ourselves,
then that's where you need to be honest about stuff.
Be honest.
Yep.
Be up front.
Yep. Okay, Kevin.
So are there any things in place for a congregation that they want to get rid of their pastor, but they can't? And like, he doesn't want to leave, he's staying there. So, like, I mean, what is it if they just turn into a more toxic place for him?
This is usually what the congregations do. Yeah.
So there's nothing in place. We just deal with it and it sucks.
Well, congregation can stop paying him. I mean, they can. You still got a call here. It's not going to pay you for doing your call anymore, and that's a pretty strong message. So you know, there are things congregations can do, and there are things pastors can do. It just gets messy, and obviously, a district official would be involved in this, hopefully sooner than later, and be helping to sort this thing out. And hopefully, somewhere in here, we're all going to try to act like Christians, which is a kind of a novel concept, but one would hope that might play into it as well. All right. Good. Now, the next thing we get into is this whole issue about how long does a call last? And Marquardt has some feelings about that, doesn't he? So, what does Marquardt think? How long is a call good for?
Till Jesus calls you home.
Or you are called to another place of service. And so, what is Marquardt really opposed to? Well, not retirement, that maybe, but a temporary call. A call with a time limit. Really, really annoyed by that. And that's where Marquardt comes into play and why he wrote his minority report to the CTCR document. That's why. And this was a perennial issue for Marquardt, and here's one of the reasons why he was so motivated by this. Because as a seminary faculty member, ever since the walkout, I will never get a lifetime call. Nope, we don't have them here. When a sem prof is called, he is called for 3 years. And his first 3 years, at the end of that, he has to be called again, has to be renewed. And that's true for this first two cycles. And after he's there for 6 years, then he gets what's called a rollover call. And it rolls over without having to be officially done, but it's always up in 3 years. So theoretically, and I don't even know where I am in the cycle now when my 3 years is up, but if a man was doing something in the office which was problematic, they can get rid of him, because at the end of his 3 years, hey, your call's done. You're not called here anymore, and that's that. And you're gone, exactly. And that's why they did it. Because before the walkout, they actually had tenure, and they had guys, and how do you get rid of them? Well, you don't, and that was a huge problem. And so that's where they came up with this idea of just a three-year call. Now, Marquardt was teaching at Fort Wayne Seminary. Guess what kind of call he had? Three-year cycle call. Do you think he liked that very much? No. And so that's why it was very personal to him, because he actually had one of those kinds of calls, like I do. I still think theologically it's got problems, and Marquardt makes his case for that, because you're basically telling God what God can do or how long he wants this to happen. But this is where you start having, and I would rather see the CTCR document kind of hit it from this side, you have this kind of interface here. Is it a divine call? Yeah. But there's a human aspect, and the human aspect is we don't want guys to get tenured in situations where we don't want them there forever, or sometimes situations don't last forever. And so because of the human aspect, sometimes we have to put a time limit on it. And I don't think that invalidates the divinity of it, but it does create some theological messiness.
With the walkout, they would still have been persistent false doctrine.
Well, that's a hard thing to pin down, though. Okay. As you begin to, if you've ever gone through this process, it takes a long time to get that pinned down and get it worked out and get it done.
Streamline the persistent false doctrine process.
That's part of it.
Okay.
And it's just to not get into a situation where we're stuck with a bunch of faculty who are wrong, and what are we going to do with them? This way, they're always under control in a sense. So that's what's going on. And like you guys, most of you didn't know this, So that's not widely known in the church, but that's how it works. And so then there are other situations too, where you have a guy who maybe gets called to a synodical office. And so he's called to be president of the synod. Well, for how long? 3 years. Yeah. And so that bothers some people too. No, he should be called. But wait a minute, he is elected. So it gets funny because you have this divine human interface again. Okay? All right, so we have that. And so that's kind of what's going on there, the whole lifelong thing. Now, the last part of this chapter, I want to make sure we cover this too, and then we'll pick up the CTCR document with some of the loose ends there. And this is this whole issue of the man who is called is in the office, and we need to honor that and respect that. And this is where it starts getting into the whole idea of being rite vocatus, and if you're not in the office, you don't act like you're in the office. And we need to honor this. And this gets back to the whole thing you guys were asking about at the very beginning, about communion by lay people or, you know, preaching by lay people. Is it legitimate or not? Is it right or is it proper? And these kinds of things. And that's that whole quote on page 163. And the driving issue here then is that the question about the efficacy of a sacrament has nothing to do with the man who does it. Okay? Nothing to do with the man who does it. And this is back to Kevin's question on day one when he was asking about fathers baptizing babies. And I was not crazy about that. It's not because the father is invalid. Is it a valid baptism? Yeah, of course. The problem has nothing to do with the baptism. The problem has everything to do with the office of the ministry. And see, it's the same thing with the Lord's Supper. Why don't you have lay people leading the Lord's Supper? It has nothing to do with the Lord's Supper. It has everything to do with the office of the ministry. Okay? And it's the same thing with having, you know, women help out with the distribution of the sacrament. It has nothing to do with the efficacy of the sacrament or the sacrament. It has everything to do with the office of the ministry and with our understanding of the role of women in the church. That's the issue. So you need to kind of sort out what's really going on here. And the problem then is this, that if we start allowing people to do the sacrament who are not rightly called, we're basically violating AC 14. And then what's at stake is not, oh no, we've just violated some document. Well, it is a document that we are, you know, confessing, and that's kind of significant. But even more importantly, what's going on then is we're actually attacking and eroding the office of the ministry. That's the big concern. And see, that's why I believe AC 14 matters. It's not like it's just thrown in there to kind of be a monkey wrench to keep things, you know, special for the pastors. It's because the office of the ministry needs to remain the office. And this gets back to the point I made a few weeks ago that who loses when the office of the ministry is lost is not the pastor, it's the people who lose their shepherd, the people who lose their absolution man, the people who lose their man who stands there and says, I've got the vestments on, I've got the clerical collar on, I'm the guy saying, thus saith the Lord to you. My word is God's word. Believe it. Receive it. This is God's gift to you. See, they lose that. They lose that when he's just the everyman, when he's just one more guy out of the herd. Something's lost. And that's why AC 14 matters, and that's why it matters who does the Lord's Supper and who does baptisms ordinarily. Okay? So now we have the question about what about an emergency situation? And this is important because emergency situation has become a great big excuse for all kinds of things. And because in an emergency, who can do a sacrament?
Anybody
in emergency. So if we've got somebody who's on his deathbed who needs to be baptized, who can baptize him?
Anybody.
And if we've got somebody who needs to hear the absolution proclaimed, there's no pastor around to do it, who can do it?
Anybody.
All right. So there we have ourselves a real live emergency. And in an emergency situation, anybody can step in and do what needs to be done. So, well, that's convenient. So, what about out here in the vast plains of the great high north of Montana, where there's no clergy within 100, 300 miles, and we have a group of people who need to have word and sacrament? This, my friends, is an emergency situation. And so because of this emergency situation, we're going to authorize a layperson to do word and sacrament ministry because this is an emergency situation. This is precisely the argument that has been made. Okay? Now, does that argument hold water?
Depends.
Well, let's take a look at some stuff in Marquardt. Stuff you probably didn't read because it's a footnote. Footnote 48. Well, first of all, footnote 44, and then we'll go to 48. 44 on page 162. So we're reading here, and this is from
talking about emergency situations. Of course, everyone who thus departs from the order must also know why he does this. The basis for this, however, is none other than the one which God's word itself cites, namely that love is the fulfilling of the law. He who does not know this basis and does it nonetheless by the seat of his pants sins against conscience and misuses his Christian liberty. Besides, one must also carefully consider that one may depart from God's order in an emergency, and this is Walter writing, this is from Lara and Vera, only so long and so far as the emergency persists. Continuing to break the order without necessity while appealing to love would be mere self-will and contempt of the divine order and majesty which has established such order. So, if there's an emergency, okay, when it's over, it's over. All right? So, if you have an emergency situation, the guy steps in and does it, okay, but when the emergency is done, he steps back. All right, that's good. Now, footnote 48. So, now we have, I'll pick it up on, very bottom of the page. This is number 22. No emergency exists whereby keeping the divine order, souls are obliged to take upon themselves only a temporal and bodily inconvenience. Flip the page. This is a long footnote. People who live at some distance from established congregations often, in order to violate the divine order, make an emergency of something which is not actually an emergency. If they must perchance travel 10 to 20 miles in order to get to neighboring Lutheran preachers, then they call that an emergency in respect to the reception of the word and sacraments because it is inconvenient, too far, or too costly to make their way there. And on that account, they request a traveling preacher, while they should be glad if this is possible for them to travel hundreds of miles in order to receive baptism for as yet unbaptized baby from a regularly called preacher rather than break the order. That sort of thing is, after all, not a spiritual but a bodily emergency for the sake of which the divine order may not be broken. A spiritual emergency exists only where, by observing the divine order, the soul would come into the danger of being lost. Now, that's pretty straightforward. So do we have an emergency in Montana? No. And keep in mind, when did Walter write this? Tail end of the 19th century. When he says 10 or 20 miles, how are you traveling that 10 or 20 miles? You're either walking it or in a buckboard wagon. How long is that going to take you? And when he says travel hundreds of miles to get a baby baptized, what does that mean, literally, for them? Probably a week's journey. And he says they should be glad they could do it. Yeah. So then you end up with the emergency halfway there. But but my point is this. Walter is pretty clear on what an emergency is. So do we really have any emergencies existing in our culture today? It's pretty hard to make a case for this. Pretty hard, yeah. And so the emergency situation is one of these crises that arises. But just talk about an ongoing emergency situation. Really, I think Marquardt's right here is really just being sloppy and not paying attention to what you need to do. Yep.
So I'm just thinking, I guess, in a more logistical sort of way in which, because it's inconvenient, they just won't do it, and in which case that becomes...
Well, that's a different issue. I mean, there you got questions of discipline and, you know, discipleship.
I mean, I'm not saying it's perfect, but I'm just saying in that scenario, people just won't even...
Well, that could be... That's true. But see, then you have to ask the question, you know, are these people being catechized? What kind of... Are they really understanding what's going on? There are other issues involved there. But, yeah. I get that. Yeah. Yep. Kevin.
So a congregation that can't afford a pastor, should they no longer be?
Well, that's where it gets interesting. So a congregation that can't afford a pastor, probably what they need to be doing is being in conversation with the congregation down the road and to figure out how they can share a pastor, they can make sure there's somebody there to fill that office for them. And if they get to the point where they just can't, then they need to ask the question of why are we existing? Maybe it's time for us to just start driving 40 miles and going to that other church. I mean, that's kind of the reality. And these are hard things. Nobody likes the idea of closing a congregation, but it's also the reality we have to face that you need to be able to have the word present in the pastoral office. And if you can't, you can't. So it gets hard. It gets hard mostly because of our polity, because we have these congregations that are autonomous. Rome never has these troubles. When they need to close a parish, they close the parish. And that's how they do it. It always cracks me up. Rome does this kind of stuff. They'll announce, we're going to combine these two parishes. And everybody in the parish says, no, you can't. And they start to protest and write letters and they go on the news. And they're, you know, because they're all thinking they're all Americans and they think they can protest. And the church, of course, yeah, they listen and they're concerned. And then what happens? They close. Yeah. It's not, you know, everybody forgets Rome is not a democracy, it's a dictatorship. It's the way it works. The word comes down, it's down. There's something really attractive about that. All right, it works. Okay, now, CTCR document. We got 6 minutes. There's stuff we haven't covered you want to ask about that was in this document. It's a long beast, and I've already hit a lot of stuff. I got one more thing I want to make sure I talk about, and the rest of it's yours. Well, two things. I want to talk about retirement. So, what is retirement for a guy who's in the office? When do you retire from the office?
I was going to ask you, what's the best retirement tech?
Yeah. You see, and so what I would say is, you don't ever retire from the office. Essentially, what my personal opinion on this is pretty strong, and maybe I'm a minority on this, but I put this in the context of vocation and creatureliness and doing what God gave you here to do. And I would contend that when God puts you in the office, you're in the office until the day God kills you. That's it. And the idea of, yeah, I can't wait for my retirement, I can't figure out why pastors talk that way. I just can't. I don't get it. Now, because if you, like, you're aiming for retirement. Now, the reality is, as you age, you're going to have a harder time keeping up. I get that. So my dad's 84 now, okay? He's a pastor, as I already hinted at, a Springfield grad. So he quit serving actively in the parish, but when he quit serving actively as a parish pastor, did he stop being a pastor? No. In fact, he started doing other things. He started, you know, kind of stepping down stuff, volunteering in Alaska for a while and doing some, you know, short stint vacancies different places. And so now he's doing less and less. But now what he still does, even though he's retired in Northeast Nebraska, Mondays he goes up to the nursing home and he visits the old people and shares a devotion with them. And does this every week. And goes and to pre-K and volunteers on Friday mornings and, you know, help the four-year-olds, which he loves doing. And so he's doing what he's able to do at this point. But is he still in the office? Yeah, he is. And he even still gets, you know, buttonholed to help out of the congregation every once in a while when the pastors are gone, and to lead something or even do the sacrament on sometimes. And he can do that because he's still in the office. Is he actively serving as much as he was? No. But see, he never aimed at retirement so I can go sit on a lake with my fishing pole. He just realized, I'm not able to go full tilt anymore, but I'm still serving using the gifts I have. And I think that's the right attitude to have. And I would contend that a guy, even when he steps out of his call officially, is still in the office and can still be used as a pastor in the office. And we honor him that way right up until the day he dies, and then he's buried as a pastor in the office, which is how we do it. And that's appropriate. That's right. Okay? Yeah, Adam.
We talked last time about laity taking communion. So would you say then we should be seeking out and finding elderly pastors who could go visit shut-ins?
That would be an awesome thing if you've got that available. That's a great gift. And you don't always get that, but if you have that available, yeah, that's a good thing. So yeah, the problem of, you know, shut-ins and who's taking the sacrament to them because you don't want to violate AC 14. Yeah, if you can find a pastor to help in any capacity, that's a great boon. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Okay, the last thing I wanted to mention was CRM status. How many of you have heard of that? So, yeah, not many. CRM is Candidate for the Reserve Ministry. It's actually a Latin title, but it means the same thing. And CRM is basically a man who's in the office, but for whatever reason has to leave his call where he is, and he's kind of between calls for such a period of time that he goes into this other status. So he's still a rostered pastor, but he's CRM, all right? And that means he could be called, but right now he doesn't have a call. CRM is typically where you'll put a man who's maybe going through a difficult situation, like he's going through a divorce or something, and we're trying to sort things out a little bit. And so he's not serving actively, so he goes into CRM status, or other situations come up, or maybe he's got a substance abuse problem. And it's not an immoral life, but there's some issues, you know, like Kevin was, or James is trying to get at, you know, we don't want to destigmatize these things. So he goes into CRM status for a while, and he deals with these things. So maybe he doesn't go back to that congregation, but then when he's done, he does get a call to another congregation. He doesn't have to be colloquized back in, he's just CRM. So that does exist. I know about it intimately because I spent a couple years on it. Actually, about four. Because I was serving a parish for 11 years. When I decided to come back and do my grad work, I didn't take a call to St. Louis and then start doing grad work. You know, I kind of fished around for something like that, but that didn't happen. So I didn't wait. I just, boom, went. So I went on CRM status. And frankly, it's not a real comfortable place to be. I wasn't crazy about it, but that's what you got to do. And so you join all the other guys who are on CRM status, and you do that for a while. But then after, you know, I finished my degree, then I was called, so I just came out of CRM status there. So that does exist, and that's what that is. You might hear about that, so you should be aware of it.
How is substance abuse not a scandalous or ungodly?
Well, see, that's the whole question about how you're dealing with it, what's going on, and does this rise to the level of immoral life? And it's all, and I know, see, you guys get really uncomfortable, and I'm with you on this. Well, we're making judgments between sins. Well, of course we are. We do it all the time. We'll talk about this when we get to our my church discipline discussion. I have a whole lecture on that. That's an important one because sins aren't all the same. And the difference is the kind of impact it has on the community and what the kind of devastation it causes. And so when a guy is unfaithful to his wife and he is sleeping with, you know, a congregational member, that's scandalous to everybody in the congregation and the community. A guy who's comes out and says, I need some help with substance abuse. I'm, you know, abusing alcohol not rightly, and I need to take 90 days to go deal with this. Most people would say, okay, that's good. You're doing the right thing. You're handling it. Go deal with it. And there's even the question, you know, is it disease or is it choice? You know, and so these things get a little different. But it really comes down to perceptions and the kind of impact it has on the community, both the church and the wider community. All right, anything else from the CTCR document or Marquardt? Yeah, JD.
Maybe we'll come back to this, so maybe don't open it now, but the footnote on page 6.
Okay.
Just curious about that whole discussion, number 4, that deals with the Great Commission. Just because I had a pastor kind of, I don't know if you've read that.
Oh, okay, is the Great Commission only to pastors or everybody? Yeah, okay, this is
an exegetical. I had a pastor come in.
Yeah. This has become a really big deal, and some people get really worked up about this, that the Great Commission was only to the pastors. And my answer is, so? Fine. I'm not ready to go to the mat and argue exegetically that the Great Commission is for every believer. I don't care if it is or not. Because my response would be, even if Matthew 28 was aimed at the 12 and it's for the office, fine. I can live with that. I can let that go. Does that mean Lady can't do the work of the commission? Of course not. There are other places I can go to establish it. So I don't need Matthew 28 to establish it. I can establish that other places, especially like with Acts chapter 6 kind of a thing. And there are other places as well where every Christian is mandated to use the keys. So I don't need Matthew 28:19.
So in that little footnote, though, it said that was still ongoing discussion. And
yeah.
Have they resolved that?
I don't think so.
That
was still ongoing
discussion.
I'm just
curious. Where we stay.
What I have heard is most exegetes probably say, yeah, it was probably just the 12. That's kind of what they would say.
That only the...
Only the clergy then are given the Great Commission. But is that my rejoinder is that the only place where the Great Commission is given to the church? No, it's not. And so, like I said, just pinning Matthew 28 to that narrow thing doesn't eliminate everything else.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just going back to the immoral life, and this could be yes or no. You keep talking about how if a man like cheats on his wife, that's a big issue.
Mm-hmm.
But if a man comes out as having a child out of wedlock, I mean,
big issue.
But in the community today, is that
increasingly people can put up with this kind of stuff. I would say the church, we don't put up with that kind of stuff. Yeah. All right. Good. Enjoy the week, guys.